Striking terror into the hearts of criminals everywhere, Chicken Man is back. This classic campy radio series entertained listeners around the world for decades. Now Chicken Man is a podcast. Hear the first 20 episodes for free right now on Earwolf. When you need even more Chicken Man, Stitcher Premium has you covered with all 273 episodes. That is all the Chicken Man you need. Just go to stitcherpremium.com/chickenman and use promo code CRACKED at checkout to get your first month free. Hello, welcome to another episode of Cracked Movie Club, the show where we try to make you, the listener, an expert on a movie we just watched.
That's a good start.
Nice.
What fucking show is
what,
this?
What are we doing?
I'm one of your hosts, Tom Ryman.
I'm the other host, Abe Epperson.
The self-appointed movie experts at Cracked. Had to defeat many others to get this position.
Yeah, well, we took 3 to 4 decades between the two of us to really become movie experts.
We're doing Christopher Nolan this month. He's our monthly director. Well, our director this month. And we're going to be talking about his 2010 movie Inception today. With our guest, Cracked Head of Video, Cody Johnston.
Hello.
That's his voice.
That's what my voice sounds like.
You're the head of video here.
It's true.
We love your stuff.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, man. I love you.
Yeah. We knew that
I love that you love my stuff.
We invited you because we know you got some thoughts and jokes on Inception and Nolan.
Yeah.
As a whole.
Yeah.
So that's why you're
here.
As a whole.
Yeah. When was the first time you watched this, Cody?
I watched it in the theater. This is actually right before I moved to California for this job.
Ohio.
I was actually staying with my parents for like a couple of months to like, hey, I'm moving across the country.
Right.
Chill.
I remember that.
Yeah. So I saw this with my dad. I don't think my mom went. But yeah, we just went to see the movie.
What were your instant responses?
I really loved it the first time.
Right.
It's just a really well-paced, fun, wild ride.
Yeah. I was the same way. I saw it in the theater with my parents and I think my brother. But I remember having the thought like halfway through. When we're in the last act during the heist and it's cutting between the three different dream layers, I remember having the actual thought, this is the best movie I've ever seen.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
It definitely gets you.
Yeah, it got you.
Yeah.
It got
me pretty easily. And it's like 7 years ago, too, so like you know, your tastes kind of change. But I really enjoyed it.
Well, before we begin, Cody, can you give a short synopsis?
We meet our heroes. Gonna roll it back.
Yeah.
Team of idea extractors decide to implant an idea into a rich boy's brain, and
little rich boy.
They get a crack team of dream folk together, and go inside the brain, and try not to get stuck in their own brains, and our hero.
Yes.
Comes to terms with his past.
That is fantastically
pretty
done.
Solid sum up.
Those are the events of
Inception.
Yeah, that is to a T. So on the show, we like to, before we dive in, we like to take some time to do our own like reductive and frankly awful summaries. Join us on our segment, Terrible Loglines.
A man tries to order a coffee, but is denied service.
That's true. Never gets that
And
coffee.
It's never clear why that guy doesn't want to give him a coffee.
Flight attendant sees 7 sleepy people tuckered out during a flight.
Adults play with children's toys to prove they're not insane.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
They're all, every single totem is a toy.
It's a child's toy.
What a silly thing.
Leonardo DiCaprio heroically abandons his children after convincing their mother to kill herself.
That is perhaps the, like I said it last night, that is the most hilarious logline that you've given. Joseph Gordon-Levitt tells a rich Asian man to think about elephants for a few seconds in a helicopter ride.
Cool naps. I'd see that movie.
That's an alternative title from Cody.
Yeah, bitchin' nap time.
Cool naps.
A Japanese man buys an airline.
That's true. Yeah. That's all he really does. I mean, that's his contribution to the team, yeah, really, right?
I have one more.
Yeah.
Find out the plot after a couple times. Because, like, it, like, doles out information. It's, like, very clever and a smooth transition, but it doles out information so slowly.
Yeah.
And throughout the movie, when finally, like, okay, so I guess this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened to his wife. And then you finally get to, like, oh, now I can, like, root for him.
Yeah.
Right, you don't get the full picture until the end, which I forgot how long it took them to reveal, A, the train, because the train shows up a bunch of times. You don't actually see it happen until, like, way late in the movie. And then also that he was actually the one that fucked with her top and drove her insane. Like, they wait a very long time to dole that information
out. Yeah,
it's
like Act 3 in traditional storytelling structure.
Like, and that information comes out, like, when there's, like, 10 minutes left.
Right. You can almost not quite get the emotional weight of it.
Someone described it as like a puzzle box or like not a Russian roulette doll, but I'm trying to remember.
Russian nesting doll?
Russian roulette doll is one of my log lines.
You know, telescoping guns.
Yeah, telescoping guns.
And you just get to the tiniest gun.
Yeah, but like the the idea that it like you can inspect and look at the art of a Russian doll and then you open it up and you're like, oh, there's an aspect I didn't
see.
Shit,
there's a whole other doll in here,
right?
I'm not going to speak for you, but every single time that I've ever interacted with one of these puzzles, my first instance is like, oh, it opens up. And then I'm like, how many are these? It's immediately you go to just open all of them. So you inspect the first one, like, aesthetically, and then you just dive into the puzzle. And in the same way, this film is kind of like, oh, I'm just immersed in this, like, Hans Zimmer thing, and, you know, like, it's amazing, and look at that, and folding, exploding things, and wow, great. And then you're like, oh, there's, like, a bunch of puzzles that I was supposed to be thinking about, I guess.
Right.
You know, like,
you get to the very last doll, little tiny dolls. I killed my wife! Like, <"Whoa!">
Wish I knew that.
Start with that doll.
Yeah. That's a big doll.
All right.
Very tiny doll. All
right. Now that we've sort of explained what the movie's about, we're going to get into a little bit about how the film was made from pre-production to post-production in a segment we like to call Expensive Pretending. It's a lot of money to play this kind of game. Something I thought was interesting was that he originally conceived that this as a horror movie.
Yeah, that's right. Dream Stealers.
Yeah.
I can see how that would work. Yeah.
Like
the heist is
Freddy.
Better.
Yeah, heist is better.
No, the heist is he spent 10 years ruminating on it, and I'm sure he talked to his brother like he always does.
Apparently, he decided on. I read an interview where he said he landed on the heist genre instead because, in a heist movie, doling out exposition is part of the story. It's like part of what's interesting. And there's a lot of exposition to be doled out in Inception because you have to explain what the world is and explain what they're doing.
Yeah.
And that comes most, not necessarily naturally because it's still exposition, but it's entertaining and the audience is captivated by it. You know, because so much of Ocean's 11 is them explaining to us how they're going to do this or like they're talking about how they're going to do this. And then we see it's the same structure. It's always where we get glimpses of how they're going to do it, and they spend a lot of time talking about it, and then when the last act rolls around, we see it unfold, and we're like, oh!
No, you know, it's a trick. It's a dream. And that's a great point, just because, so in 2002, he, after completed Insomnia, Nolan gave Warner Brothers an 80-page treatment of his horror film, and he needed another 8 years to figure it out. And it what clicked for Warner Brothers and Legendary and what made them on board with the idea, because they were just like, how are you going to show one dream from another? Like, I just don't see it as a movie. It's like a book or something. And
like a book or some trash.
Like, yeah, like, this is a really like ambitious idea. How will you translate it? And he said, and this is a quote, I told them one of the dream levels is in the rain. One of them is night interior. One of them is outdoors in the snow. That meant that even in a close-up, you would be able to tell which level you were as you cross-cut. They were very aware of the risky nature of the project, but they got very excited about seeing the film. So he basically pitched them the visual motif that would translate the cross-cuts, which is all of Act 2 and 3.
It's something I didn't think of at all, but it's actually really, really smart.
It's smart.
Very effective,
hell.
Yeah,
and that's what gave him the budget that they needed, because he not only needed Warner Brothers, he needed Legendary, like both huge production houses.
Why did they need him? Why did he need them both?
I think it's because the budget was so high that they needed to share the load. But I don't quote me on that. But
what was
like,
the budget on this film? Like 160, something like that?
I think higher.
Higher than that? Yeah. Jeez.
I mean, when you factor in post-production and marketing, because they had a huge
$100 million marketing budget.
Yeah,
for
so
this movie.
It might have actually been closer to like 200, 250 or something. Jeez. But made its money back.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
And that was the horror version? Where he was like, no, don't worry, it's this level, this level, this level.
In 2002, he had a horror, 80-page thing that was a horror. And then over the span of 8 years, because then he made 2005, Batman Begins, 2006, Prestige, Dark Knight in 2008. So he had a few films that he was like, I'm pretty badass. And they were like, yeah, okay, and let's relook at this thing. And he's ruminating it for 8 years, and he realized it was a heist movie.
Let me do it. I fixed Batman.
I fixed the Batman.
I had read that Leo was the first person that was signed to the script. And that he was really... Nolan had wanted to work with DiCaprio for a while, but just none of the things that he would offer him, he was interested in. And then this was the first one that Leonardo DiCaprio's like, oh, this is kind of a cool idea.
Right.
But then they sat down over a couple of months, I think I read, to rework the script so that it had more of a human element in terms of DiCaprio's character had an emotional arc. Because I think at the beginning it was just the heist. Huh. So it was kind of like all the characters were like basically like Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Arthur, who's like a very...
He's just there.
He's just there. Yeah. He's a nothing character.
Yeah, he does the stuff.
He does some cool stuff, but he's like...
He's Dream 2 Alchemist. Like, there's a guy who's just there to operate the thing, and then they disappear. And the only reason we remember Joseph Gordon-Levitt
is because he has the cool fight. Yeah,
Hearing that Leo sort of had to develop that part of the movie, that makes sense because that's Nolan's movies.
Right.
Like, his movies are very emotionless for the most part.
He's not great at...
He's not great at emotion or like
at
real...
Like a, at like a personal arc. Yeah. For people. Like he's good at the plot.
Yes.
It's a common problem with him. He's got a thing with exposition. If I want to build up a character, I don't do it with deeds. I bring in someone, say like, you know, I'm Michael Caine.
Right.
You're the best one, Batman. You know, like there's a lot of scenes.
Mr. Batman.
There's a lot of scenes with people building up other people or telling the past of other people, as opposed to exposing it with like plot.
He does both in this movie, which is strange.
No, he does both all the time, but he definitely does it more than most directors, I'd say.
Yeah.
He had a special opportunity in this movie too, because Arthur just tells Ariadne, oh, Maul's dead. Like, that's really all he says.
Yeah.
And she asks how she was in real life. Oh, she was lovely.
Yeah.
Then she sneaks into Leo's dream. So rather than have... There are still elements of Leonardo DiCaprio explaining the events that happened, but Ariadne and then us as the audience actually get to see those events. So it was like an interesting opportunity where we exist in the world of this movie. The person you're explaining to can actually see the events happen.
Right.
And that's what...
Right.
Yeah. It's lucky, I guess, for him, too, that he has that device in this movie. He's like, oh, let's just show him in a dream.
Yeah.
Then they'll be there and they'll watch it.
Yeah.
You guys want to hear something stupid about Arthur?
Absolutely.
Originally, and in Nolan's mind, it wasn't Levitt. It was James Franco.
What?
But why? He passed because he had scheduling conflicts. I don't know what movie he was doing at the time.
That's not a great choice.
No, it's not. Levitt's a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's the thing about Franco is that every time I see him, I think he's like a specific thing, which we probably all can elucidate.
Yeah.
But everyone's around him, like in his behind the scenes and his like personal life, they're like, this guy's a fucking genius. Like, I think he's just very good at talking to people. And it's like, because the disaster artist. The Disaster Artist, is that the name of the film?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that's the book, Greg Sestero. The Room, with Tommy Wiseau. That's coming out. It's like, I've heard about the story of, like, what he needed to do to make that film, and it sounded like he had to just, like, a fucking circus of, like, navigation through, A, Tommy Wiseau, B, you know, like, all of his friends, C, like, Greg Sestero, the author of the film, or A, author of the book, who played Mark, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I think James Franco is probably, like, secretly smart, or not secretly, but, like, smart in a way that we don't isn't aware in his like performances.
Like socially intelligent.
I've heard.
Where like he can connect with people. Right. And, yeah.
Because his name comes up all the time as like a possible choice for other roles. Then I'm just like, nah, man. Well, but I'm an outsider. I'm a guy just watching these movies.
That might make sense. We're going to talk about it in a later segment, but in terms of this movie being about movie making, mm-hmm. Arthur's the producer.
Right.
Yes.
So if Nolan's casting James Franco based on who James Franco is in real life, that makes more sense.
Right. Real quick, I just want to say that before Ellen Page was casted, Evan Rachel Wood, Emily Blunt, Rachel McAdams, Emma Roberts, Ellen Page got the role. So she went up against some heavy hitters.
Those would all be good.
Those would all be, I thought, really good. Especially Emily Blunt, to me, is the standout just because of what she's done since. I mean, it was 2009 when, or 8 even, when it was getting cast, probably.
Yeah.
And Emily Blunt's since had a decade of, like, amazing roles. But she's always been good. Yeah. Like, she's never fucked up. Ellen Page, surprisingly, is kind of not falling off the map, but, like, I don't know what...
This is the biggest project she's picked, I think.
Yeah, right. Yeah. She's got a very particular taste,
She doesn't do big projects. She's good in this.
She's very good.
Was it just Juno before this for her?
Juno, oh, gosh.
This feels like an odd choice.
Hard Candy.
There's also some notable crew members. We got Wally back.
Yeah, Wally Pfister.
Oh, my God.
This
is a
director of photography who won another Academy Award for this movie.
Wally Pfister, baby.
This is a continuation of his work with Hans Zimmer, who he first started working with in Batman Begins and who has since scored every Nolan film.
Right, I was going to say he's never not since then.
Right, yeah. It was only Memento and Insomnia, I believe, that are not scored by... Oh, no, wait, and then Prestige. Every other film is Hans Zimmer.
And Hans Zimmer brings something. Like, I mean... Obviously. But he's like up there with, you know, Willie.
Yeah. He's really good with the Nolan movies in terms of he doesn't have, there's not really memorable cues. There is an Inception. I think Inception's an exception.
Inception.
because it has that which is actually that Edith Piaf song, Slowed Way Down.
Right.
As if you're hearing it in a dream. But the rest of the time, Hans Zimmer for like this, and in particular his score for The Dark Knight, it's all a simmering score.
Yeah, like swirling like reeds like, and shit.
It's like propelling the
drone.
It's moving everything forward. It's like it gives you a sense of constant motion, but like in a like
right. It doesn't like punctuate stuff. It's not like here's this theme that's starting for this moment.
Like in The Dark Knight, you hear the quote unquote Batman theme, like dun 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 dun. You know, like that part. Yeah. I'm not probably doing good, but you only hear it like two or three times in the movie.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe.
Right. The only thing I can really think of in my head is the Joker thing. It's the tightening. Yeah.
It's the tightening of a string. Yeah.
Right.
But that's not like a song.
No.
Yeah.
But it's
he doesn't do melody like another great composer, for example. Like, I guess I could mention anyone, but just because I watched it a few nights ago, Paranorman score, John Bryan, the guy punctuates tone. Like, he really nails tone. Because he's like, this is how things feel in this moment. Zimmer, arguably does that, but he does it in a way of like, look back at the whole scene. How do you want it to feel? Not like what's happening in this
Not
frame.
Not moment by moment.
Yeah. And it's really effective in this movie.
Definitely.
I mean, this soundtrack pulled me, like, I was almost more like, this music is amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Zimmer, he has done the big stuff. Like, you know, like his score for The Rock or Pirates of the Caribbean
is
more like that traditional score. But like this one
with
is
Nolan.
More like a, with Nolan's films, he's just.
I think that's probably Nolan's influence. Interstellar, which we'll talk about
at
some point, it has the same kind of thing, like that docking sequence.
Yeah.
You know, and shit. It's just like, oh my God.
This movie also struck me because it's the first movie I remember Tom Hardy from.
All right.
And me too.
It's so against type for Tom Hardy.
Yeah.
So, but this is like the first thing I associated with him with, so I thought this was his type. So like hearing later, it's like, oh, he's going to be Bane. I was like, really? That
right.
guy?
Right.
That very proper English dude is going to be Bane?
And proper English dude?
The way he speaks. He's like he's well-dressed. Like, he's never in a scene where he's like, in point of fact, he gets beat up in this movie. Like, he gets, in the snow level, he gets
he's
punched a lot and thrown out. He's not like a bruiser in this movie. Right. He's not
No, he
people.
Doesn't play what he's played.
He's a much more,
sense.
Yeah.
But he's like, and obviously they have other actors for it, but like, the disguiser.
Yeah.
Right? So like, he's...
Yeah,
in retrospect, it's like, oh yeah, you're just an actor. You can do whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to talk about production, if you don't mind.
Yeah, definitely.
Warner Brothers wanted this to shoot in 3D. Remember, this was during the 3D craze. I don't know if
and
you
if any movie
remember
was
this,
be
Cody.
In 3D.
Yeah. Nolan just straight up said no.
That's so cool.
And so he opted out for 35mm, but obviously this popularized, there's a few films that did it, notably Avatar, which was also 3D and like was pretty good 3D.
Yeah.
But he went to an old fucking format that hadn't been used for like decades, really, in major films. That then, I think 2009, 2010, so Inception and then Avatar and Inception made this now like it's a thing. It's like how you shoot superhero movies, which it's called VistaVision. It's 65mm, which is different from 70mm, which is 5mm larger. Mm. A bigger format that
I'm following you.
The Hateful Eight shot on, and that's Tarantino's deal. But he used the reason VistaVision was used is because it's a very, very close. And I think you can actually do a process where it's adopted, like you use the same film plane or the same film strip and put it in an IMAX camera. So this popularized IMAX in a way that it already had been started to being used.
Right, like he had shot parts of The Dark Knight or
yes,
in IMAX.
Yes, exactly. But this one, he really used it. And Fister, baby.
Mr. Baby!
Yeah, bringing
this. And now all superhero movies do that?
Well, I mean, some of them are digital now, so it's kind of changed in the last decade, but it definitely started there.
Nolan's also a director that has in the past, I mean, up through Interstellar, I'm not sure about Dunkirk, but he is opposed to digital film.
Yes. Yeah.
Very
like
much
Tarantino.
So. Like Tarantino. Yeah. And like PTA, I want to say?
PTA yeah. does not use digital. Coen's just fell to the digital.
Their argument
is...
Is
that why Hail Caesar is only okay?
No.
The immediate dip in quality when they adopt a digital camera. I mean, their arguments, I believe it's a clarity thing, and it's also like a degradation thing.
I think it's also Deakins. Deakins is like, this Alexa camera's not bad. Roger Deakins, yeah. The cinematographer.
That makes sense. If he says it's okay, then you're like, all right, do what you want to do.
And he is an exceptional, like, if not one of my, he might be my favorite. Fister's up there, but like Deakins is definitely a guy who's, in the last, like, 5 years, 6 years, like, said, like, you know what? Digital's all right. And everyone's like, all right, well, if Father Deacon says, right. You know.
Damn it, I guess I need to buy a digital camera.
If the Deeks is down.
Deacon, the Deeks.
Yeah. There was an alarming amount of not CGI in this film for how CGI it does actually look. Because there are, you know,
yeah.
crazy amounts of sequences.
I was surprised at how many of the sequences were done in camera.
Yeah, and that's obviously all the filmmakers, but there's a company called Double Negative that builds sets and, like, uses wires that is, like, you know, most pronounced in, like, the hallway scene.
Yeah, the hallway sequence I had read was a set that they had built on 8 rotating circles, basically.
Yeah.
So they could spin it. They could just spin the whole thing. So... JGL, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and the guy that he's fighting are doing that in as the set is moving in real time. So they're actually like jumping as their weight is changing. And it's one of those scenes where like this has to be CG, but it's
wasn't that
not.
2001? Didn't they do something similar with the ship?
Yeah,
actually, exactly right. And not only that, Nolan argues that 2001, that's what gave him the idea to do like the hallway sequence and stuff. Like he's like, I want to do something where it's like,
right, you want to see the whole thing.
Yeah, Kubrick famously was just like, how are we going to do this, you know? And he was like, we'll just build a rig,
make a tube and spin it.
So you mean like revolve the world? He's like, I'm Kubrick.
Yeah. Wally Pfister also had a hand in building that rotating set.
Yeah.
Because the camera.
Because the camera's moving.
Yeah.
And so there had to be a mechanism of, like, it's rigged to the ground so that it didn't reveal that, like, the world is flipping. Because it's not like you can have an operator standing there
when
the world is being flipped around. So it was obviously on a track
I want them to have tried that. Without it occurring to anybody at first.
That poor cameraman.
Yeah, just rattling just like, around.
Well, not the poor camera. I mean, he could have, but like, if I was that cameraman, first off, I'd surround myself in just padding, but then I'd not care when the camera breaks, you know, because it'd just fly out of my hands.
Right.
More about production, there is an alarming number of locations. Principle for photography began in 2009 in Tokyo, where Saito.
JGL mispronounces it in the movie, yeah, so you can be forgiven for that.
Did you do it on purpose?
I also have a friend.
I think he does
friend.
It. I'm not sure if he just keeps Saito. Saying Saito, yeah. Which is not right.
Or Mal, or Maul. He first hires Cobb in the helicopter flight. That's in Tokyo. Then they went to the UK and shot the in a airship hangar for the hotel bar. So like right up front was the rotating.
Yeah, and that set. Bit. You know, when he's talking to Fisher and he's like, "Look, the gravity's weird, the weather's strange." Mm-hmm. If they built it on basically a set that would tilt the 40 degrees or however much
30,
it is,
yeah,
something like that.
They went to France and they shot Cobb entering the College of Architecture and the scenes between Ellen Page
and
Leo. And that's where Pfister used high pressure nitrogen to do the explosions in the cafe scene.
Are they actually blowing up the fruit?
They actually were blowing shit up. And they, I think, only shot it once, but Pfister used 6 high speed cameras from different angles. And then they decided in post which one to use. he was just like, Nolan and him were like, "That's a good angle. Yeah, that's a good angle."
That's probably.
We only get like one shot at this, so let's just bring a bunch of cameras.
I imagine.
And then we'll just choose it later.
Because that's like historic buildings in France.
Right.
So I imagine they're pretty much like, well, you can't blow anything up.
Yeah. Right. And there is CG in that shot, but it's it's just like additional debris and shit. Yeah. Then they went to Tangier. In Morocco, which doubled as Mombasa, which, by the way, has the... What is with... You remember when he escapes the 2 cronies?
Yeah.
He goes through that really thin hallway. What is the point of that hallway?
I'll tell you when we get to...
I was going
to... bullshit, yeah.
All right.
I'll tell you what that
is. Well, anyway, that's Tangier. It also doubled for the bombing scenes at the beginning of the movie when they're in...
Oh, right. Yeah, when they're in...
Ken Watanabe's brain.
Oh, they're not. They're in Lucas Haas. Oh, yeah. They're in Little Boy from Witness Brain.
Good call. Little Boy from
Witness. Little Boy from Witness.
That is a distant pull. I love
it. So he is. He's in Brick, too.
They also shot in Los Angeles. That's right. They shot in Los Angeles and built on Warner Brothers soundstage. Interior rooms for the Japanese castle.
Oh, right. Saito's Palace.
Yeah. And they also shot on Malibu Beach. That was all the beach scenes.
Was that
scenes.
The cliff for the...
Yes, both. And also getting into Mall and Cobb's.
Where the kids are and then... the limbo.
That's a lot... That was probably the most CG-heavy segment, obviously, because there was expansive lack of population.
Oh, and there's also the scene where they're all like... All of them finally get together and they're like planning. They're standing in the middle of Wilshire Boulevard. With everything's cleared out.
The first dream was on the LA streets. The train was actually, they just put a train engine on the chassis of a tractor. And then they just rammed it in.
I assumed the train was CG.
No.
Just fucking ram it in.
Most of it, except, but not the head
not the
car.
Not the engine?
Yeah, and then they like put parts on it.
Okay,
that looked like a train and then rammed it in.
Yeah, it's probably safer.
Yeah. He did that in Dark Knight as well.
I was going to say that lunatic bullshit. He flipped that fucking 18-wheeler. Yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah. Christ.
They actually flipped that car. There was a man driving that car when they flipped it.
Yeah.
It also looked amazing.
Also,
such a good shot.
If you remember from earlier in this podcast, the point of the first one is that it was raining. Like, that was a big thing. So they shot in L.A. So what they had to they had to essentially build rooftop water cannons just to keep it drizzling the whole time.
Wow. Yeah, we're gonna
everywhere they shot.
Little bit of local knowledge for our non-LA listeners. It never rains here.
Yeah, we're in
certainly
a desert.
Certainly not in the amount that it does.
No,
in LA.
Not more than like a couple hours.
LA
once
don't rain.
In months.
Also, more LA problems. The climactic scene where the van flies off the bridge in slow motion.
I read about that. They shot it out of a cannon.
Out of a cannon. They didn't drive it because it had to be reproduced over multiple days. They shot it, like, the inside stuff all in one day. But all of that fucking fallen high-speed cameras. But they had to shoot it multiple times. And so they had to be, like, reproducible and cut. And so they were like, oh, a driver can't, like, perfectly do this.
Right.
A stunt driver's just like, okay, I'm as safe as I can be.
Also,
and here
very
we go.
Dangerous to back a van into the water then that's like a 30-foot drop at least.
It makes a lot of sense to just take out the human element.
Don't put a person in that.
Let's use physics for this.
Don't make a person do that.
So they built a cannon to shoot a van out of a bridge. It's amazing.
I did read that, and I loved that detail.
Also, the actors had to be underwater for 4 to 5 minutes during that segment. When
I assume they
holding
did.
Their breath.
That they had scuba stuff, like it would be kind of like James Cameron does, or famously was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna. How long can you hold your breath? I don't know, 60 seconds. Can you make 90? And then it's like, all right. And then he's like, and then I'm gonna do it 6 times. But don't worry, you got like. So obviously they were all safe and stuff.
The actors, maniacs.
I think Nolan's probably a lot better than Cameron.
Because
Cameron just thinks that the sea is like him.
There's a famous shot in The Abyss when they go into the nuclear submarine and there's a dead guy, a lot of dead people floating in there, for long shots. None of those dead people are dummies. They're all actors.
They're not dead though, right?
No.
So they just close their eyes and act.
And
that dead.
And there's one that has that they linger on because a crab crawls out of them. That's like Jim Cameron's brother-in-law.
Oh my god!
Like that's a live dude. Go back and watch.
But
that.
Yeah, I mean, use that shot.
Yeah. Also, in The Abyss, Etta Harris punched.
He sure did.
Cameron.
He sure did.
Why?
Because he almost drowned.
Yeah.
We'll definitely.
No drownings in Inception.
The last location was, and the last thing they shot in Canada was the Ice Fortress.
Oh sure.
That is a lot of locations for a single film.
It really is. Wow. You know? Yeah. But I mean, when you say that the third act of your film is going to be in three very distinct locations, that's what you're asking for.
Right.
Pretty much, yeah.
Last thing I want to talk about in production is the post-production element. Nolan never thinks about making sequels. He's even said in interviews, even like Batman Begins, he doesn't think about the next one. He just wants to make a good film.
That's good.
But he'd love to see an Inception video game, which would be awesome.
Sure, man.
I mean, I'll play that game.
Like, he's out. He's set.
Does he know he can make that happen very easily?
I don't know. Why does he do it?
He should just tell somebody that's not, like, doing an article on it.
I will play the shit out of Dream Making,
like
man.
Like, Christopher Nolan.
Heist movie?
You can tell people, hey, make an Inception game. They'll be like,
yes, we will do this. Yes, I will. Yes, I would like to print money.
we will make this game.
One last thing I want to talk about in post-production before we move on to, like, the more symbolic unpacking kind of stuff, which I'm sure Cody you'll enjoy. It got Oscars for best cinematography, sound editing, mixing,
the most of any Nolan film, right?
Visual effects. It's the most winningest for Nolan, and they're all technical awards though. So best film, director, screenplay, which he was nominated for, also in the BAFTAs and the Golden Globes, but lost out to of the same year, The Social Network and The King's Speech.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't agree with that.
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely the three, most technical. But I think that Social Network and King's Speech, I think King's Speech should have gotten, I mean, should have gotten
that's
the best film. It's
yeah,
the best
that's,
film.
That's
but
Social
Network, I don't know if it deserves, you know, director, screenplay.
No. Yeah, like it's good, but it's not award good.
Yeah, it was fine. Like there are other Fincher movies that are here's your best director award.
Right.
And
this
I think
this is the one you feel.
I think that Nolan kind of has kind of what Spielberg had at the beginning of his career. He's kind of like a not gimmicky filmmaker, but like a or a, like as he was thought of by
he's
the Academy.
He's a commercial filmmaker, so they're not willing to acknowledge that you're pretty good.
Yeah, like you're Dark Knight. You're really proficient at making like popcorn
movies. Pretty
right.
good,
but I mean like The King's Speech.
Right.
You're not Hooper.
Not allowing the idea of like, oh, you made a really good movie, and Batman happens to be the main character in it.
Yeah,
they just see the Batman.
They see the Batman. Yeah. And they're like, that's middle tier.
Right.
But he's definitely deserved a lot of those awards.
On August 15th, hop in the TARDIS and travel back to 1983, the year I was born. Don't miss a night of legendary riffing when the stars of Mystery Science Theater 3000, Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett take on the classic Doctor Who film, The Five Doctors, broadcast live to movie theaters nationwide. If you can't make it on August 15th, catch the rebroadcast on August 24th. For locations and to purchase tickets, visit www.fathomevents.com/rifftracksdoctorwho. Even if you're not a big Doctor Who fan, like I am ashamed to admit that I'm not, the Rift Tracks live events, the Fathom events, are always a lot of fun. I've been to a few. I've seen them do Starship Troopers. I saw them do a bunch of Christmas shorts. They're always a real fun, really good time. And it's pretty cheap. You know, it's just the price of a movie ticket. You go out and you get to spend a couple hours with these guys just doing what they do. You know, if you're a fan of MST3K, these are all the original guys. And they're going to be talking about this Doctor Who movie that was made the year I was born. So that's my connection to this. Once again, that's going to be on August 15th with a rebroadcast on August 24th. For locations and to purchase tickets, visit www.fathomevents.com/rifftracksdoctorwho. Hey everyone, another great show just joined Earwolf. Whether you grew up watching James Bond movies like I did, that was one of the first video cassettes we had, was just Goldfinger, so I've seen that movie more than any child probably should have. Or if you're just getting into James Bond movies, you're going to love this show. It's called James Bonding. You may know Matt Gourley from other Earwolf podcasts, like I Was There Too. He was also a guest on Harmon Quest last season. If you do, you know he's obsessed with James Bond, and so is his co-host, Matt Myra, from the Nerdist podcast. On each episode of James Bonding, Matt and Matt bring a guest like Paul Scheer, Tom Lennon, or Doug Benson to deep dive on a Bond movie, or rank the best villains, gadgets, scores, and whatever. There's a new episode each week. They just released a special tribute to Matt's favorite Bond, Roger Moore. So subscribe to James Bonding in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.
That's how the movie was made. We should get into some observations.
Yeah, now we're going to get some observations in a little segment we like to call Hidden Bullshit.
Secret things.
Every dream, they keep referencing, you know, how Dom has Ariadne try out is that he has her draw a series of mazes. So every dream is built as a maze. And consequently, every true life setting we're in is also like a place that's just a series of corridors.
Yeah.
Like, you see the overhead shots of, you see aerial shots of Tokyo, Mombasa, and I think Paris. But they're all, like, kind of fractals and also kind of yes. maze-like, particularly Mombasa. And that's meant to represent two things, which is, one, it's meant to represent, one, that dreams are a subset of reality, which Dom actually talks about when he's teaching Ariadne how to build them. Dreams are, you know, heightened and things happen that can't happen in reality, but they are drawing from the same tool set, basically. So you're drawing from things that exist, but you're doing them in a way that can exist.
Yeah.
So these mazes and stuff like that are actually things that exist. And it's also meant to symbolize that Dom is losing touch of what's real and what's not.
Mm.
And
yeah.
that Mombasa thing that I wanted to bring up, that's the scene that most clearly is like, this might not be real. Because Mombasa's most maze-like, he runs himself into a maze that seems to be closing in on him
right.
while he's being chased by, like, faceless, anonymous
Who
agents.
Are those people?
Yeah, from some corporation. So that is, I think, those images are repeated and done very deliberately. Like,
yeah, and there's a line when they drive up, Ken Watanabe picks him up, and they drive up to Hardy, because he's like, we'll meet back here. Because we'll meet back at the place that we started, because that's the last thing they'll expect. So when they drive up, Hardy's like, what's this car? And who's that?
Yeah,
that's
what you call losing a tail.
Yeah, that's what you call losing a tail. And he's like, what is this? And he calls it a different tail. So in other words, that the solution to the problem is something that is what they expected, but not quite what they expected. Like, they still accomplished the goal, but they did it through a, you know, navigation of things that they just didn't think was possible, which is very maze-like, because it's like you go down one branch and you're like, is this gonna get me home? I don't know, but the whole goal is just get to the center of the maze or get out of the maze.
And also right. if you get lost in a maze, what do? You go back to where you started from and
exactly.
then try something else.
Exactly.
So that's right. where he meets Tom
if you're
Hardy
trying
back.
To go yeah. left, you might have to go right,
right.
for a long time
yeah.
in order
and
to
then
get back to that.
Yeah, yeah, you don't know. So you have to try a different tactic every time, and
yeah.
it's a steady operation. It's really cool.
And then, of course, the other way that they keep—I mean, you keep Dom is continuously checking his top. So that's like the more obvious way of letting you know that he's kind of struggling with where he is. But all the environments he finds himself in are all—they're all mazes.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hesitate to call it sweatily. But the very sweatily named Ariadne is a reference to the Maze of the Minotaur.
Yeah.
So Ariadne is the lady who guides Theseus through the maze. And
mm-hmm.
she guides Leo through the maze mm-hmm. when they're in the heist.
Nolan.
Yep.
You had some really cool thoughts about like what this movie's about, mm-hmm. like the room 237 of this, and specifically about filmmaking, right?
Yeah, I had two different thoughts actually. There's one is that it's actually about filmmaking, and that's an observation that
he's made.
I can't claim that one. A lot of other people made it, and I read in an interview with him that he sort of gets down. He's like, well, yeah, a lot of my movies end up, you can interpret them that way. It's just because of the imagery he chooses, and because he likes the themes of playing with perception, reality, and that's very much what filmmaking
right,
is.
Right.
So those
Memento
kind of subconsciously work their way in there anyway.
But you mean specifically that the casting of
the team is like
a filmmaking
team. The roles
team.
Are like Dom's the director. Saito is the money man, like the studio. Ariadne's
the producer,
the,
a little bit.
Yeah.
One of the producers.
The money producer. Yeah. Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Arthur, is like the producer.
He's the line producer.
Yeah.
Like AD
that's
kind
the person.
Of stuff. Like.
Yeah. I mean,
he like figures out the timing of the kicks and everything.
That's true. That's a good point.
He's like organizing everything to run on the set, quote unquote, when it needs to. Ariadne's the writer.
Eames is the actor.
And Fisher's the audience. Because they're all working to make Fisher feel a specific emotion.
Right.
And which is what movies are.
Yeah. Not necessarily what Nolan's movies are, but but what generally movies are.
But filmmaking in general, they want to make you feel a specific thing. And Dom's line when he says a positive emotion trumps a negative emotion every time, but that's Nolan's opinion. Like, that's what he feels. Like, I read this in an interview with him. That is his opinion of filmmaking and storytelling is it's much more powerful to instill a positive emotion in the audience than it is a negative one.
It's probably easier or harder too.
Like they make a point of that too in the film where like Tom Hardy's arguing, it's like, well, it's better. Like you work back to the simplest form of the idea, which is his relationship with his father.
Right.
And then they're figuring out that, well, it needs to be this positive thing will take easier, but it's more difficult.
Because you can make anyone feel afraid pretty easily or like angry or like can get someone worked up with all those negative emotions.
But it's really hard to make someone think about elephants.
Really hard to make someone think about elephants.
Oh, no, now I am.
Oh, I did it, guys. I am a director.
You incepted us. You got dream thieved.
Didn't you have some thoughts about the group?
Yeah, this is more of my own theory that I thought of just while I was writing. It might also be about the grief process.
Ooh.
Dom, obviously, is trapped in the guilt stage of the grieving process, where he's consumed by guilt over his dead wife, because it's a Nolan movie. Mm. the way he works out of that is he organizes a team to guide Fisher through his grieving process over the loss of his father, which is... I feel like it's deliberate because there's a scene where Dom demands that Saito tells him why he wants them to do this because he's like, you don't understand, incepting an idea in someone's mind will transform their entire life. Like, I am going to change this man and I want to know that it's for a good reason.
Right.
And they're like, well, it's because of this and it's like the shadowy thing. But then the more they learn about Fisher, the more they learn that he has this terrible, poisonous relationship with his father. He's like a sad man.
Yeah.
They wind up, they do this whole thing, which, you know, it's to achieve a specific goal, breaking up the company, but they achieve that goal by giving Fisher peace.
Yeah, forgiveness.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's...
So they work him through the grieving process, and in order to do that, Dom has to let go of his own guilt. Like, he has to go down to his lower level and tell Maul that, I have to let you go. Like, you're not...
Yeah.
He has to
finally see my faceless children.
Right. They
you
have
can,
faces
can,
in my
but
dreams!
Let me spin this top real quick. By the way, Michael Caine has... Apparently, he had a conversation with Nolan. And Nolan, of course, being a filmmaker, is going to be like, you know, I'm not going to cop to this is what the ending means.
Right.
But Michael Caine has said in interviews, it's not a dream.
Okay.
Like, it's real.
Yeah.
Well, and this
makes the most sense.
Yeah. And another thing is, I've read stuff since, and Nolan actually said this, so I was able to pat myself on the back very hard. But... I always thought that the point of the ending was that he puts the top down to spin it, but he doesn't stay and watch it because he doesn't care anymore because it doesn't matter to him anymore.
Right, because he's finally at peace.
Right.
Right.
Because he works through his own
reality.
Grief
yeah.
and he's at peace with what he has and it no longer matters to him because he was able to let that guilt go.
Right. That was the first... When I first saw it, that's what I got. I was like, oh, it doesn't really matter if it's a dream or it's not. It's just his reaction to it is what
that's
we should
what's
be.
Important. Yeah. Yeah,
is the top Cobbs?
That's the other thing that
I don't think it is.
Yeah.
You had an interesting point, right? The wedding ring?
It's not. That's not my point. I didn't come
you
up
didn't
with
make
that.
It. Okay.
But there's a theory that his totem is actually his wedding ring and
right.
not the top,
because
they do specifically
only,
say
yeah.
that the top is Maul's totem.
Well, also
right.
JGL
and you're not
says
supposed to
don't
touch,
touch
each
mine.
Yeah.
I only, or, I'm the only one that understands it.
Everyone can't touch each other's because that's the only way you know.
Right. Yeah.
So obviously it works in the film because it's like. Well, they're married and they loved each other so much that it was okay for them to, like, get into each other's totems. But it was clearly said...
Get into my totem!
Get into my totem,
that's
baby!
Part of, that's part
yeah,
of being
get out
married.
Of my dreams and into my totem.
Into my totem. Get all up in each
but,
other's totems.
Yeah, someone pointed out on the internet or like, somewhere.
Yeah.
Probably the internet, because I don't... like.
Likely
yeah.
the internet.
Yeah. Likely the internet. His wedding ring is only...
He's only wearing his ring in his dreams.
In his dreams.
And yeah. in the scenes that are explicitly dreams.
Which seems like, because of all of the cross-cutting, such an explicit instruction for...
I never noticed it.
No one, of
yeah.
course.
Yeah.
Of course.
So
how
subtle.
Often do you notice yeah. wedding rings? I never
I noticed his wedding ring, but I didn't...
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, he's wearing it because he's a grieving
right,
man.
But
he's racked by guilt.
Right.
And it feels intentional. And,
I don't 100%
and why
see.
Would it be other than to... nod to the secret fact.
Yeah, I mean, they shot a van out of a cannon. They probably thought about, like, when he's going to wear his wedding ring.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah.
Well, I mean, if you know anything about filmmaking on this level, it's like, it's not like you show up wearing a tie and they're like, that's the tie.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like,
yeah,
they're going to be like, well, let's look at your hand and
yeah.
face and everything
yeah,
about
there's,
you.
There's a person that gets paid to
yeah.
only notice those
yeah.
things.
Right.
Yeah.
And I feel like kind of a shit for saying this, but in all the subsequent interviews with Nolan that I've read about this, it's like, wow, he's a pretty thoughtful guy. Like, he thinks about all of this shit.
Yeah. yeah.
Like, he's like, yeah, the sandcastles they're building, that's the cast, that those are the has.
It
you,
should
you
look
see,
like.
You see
yeah.
the children building sandcastles, then you see Dom and Maul building their sandcastles, and then when you get back there at the end, the buildings are falling into the ocean like the sandcastles.
Right.
And at the end of the movie, the kid has, when he comes home and he spins the top and he walks away from it, you hear the kid say, I built a house. And you see, because he built a house with blocks. It's like, ah!
He's an architect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, good. He's a good director.
Mm-hmm. He's a very talented director.
So, I think there's little chance that the wedding ring is accidental. Probably zero chance that it's
yeah.
accidental.
As soon as I read about that, I was like, oh, that's... That, I accept that.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no
like,
other
oh, that's explain. Pretty good. Yeah.
yeah.
Like,
it's
up to us, obviously, to interpret what it means exactly. But yeah, that was not an oversight.
Yeah.
I want to segue to a segment that talks about scenes that enhanced or ruined the plot. And we like to call it bonus scenes that should have existed. I got one. You got one?
Yeah. I actually have two now.
Because
of what we stumbled upon earlier. I really want to see what's up with that flight attendant. Because she knew the whole dream-stealing process. Because she busted out that suitcase and like hooked everybody up and turned it on and then closed their curtain. And then also, she's the only witness to these events. So she has to be somebody that Saito pretty much trusts a whole lot. Because it can't get out that they fucking dream-jacked Robert Fisher. Or else they're all going to go to prison. So either she's like another Dom Cobb type who's just like an excellent dream thief because she knows the whole process clearly.
Right.
Or she's just like, maybe both. She's just an extreme confidant of Saito.
Yeah.
Like she has to have, there has to be like a fascinating story behind that character.
The Saito angle is more likely because he bought the airline.
He did buy the airline.
So
yeah.
he
oh, yeah.
gets control of who's
of
on
the staff.
The plane.
Right. I'm saying, yeah, I agree. He got to put that person there. But who is that person?
Yeah. And why? The bonus scene that I want to see is, it's already a scene, but early up top in Act 1 is the phone call between Cobb and his children and his Maul's mom. The other side of that phone call is fucking batshit if you really look at that scene. Because
yeah.
it's like, hand the phone to grandma, and then the kid's like, she's shaking her head, and then the phone just abruptly hangs up. Like, it sounds like it's just a terrible grandma who's
yeah.
just like, what do you, like, call your father. And then the second that she immediately changes her mind, I'm like, don't. Because it's not like these children were like, I'm going to call daddy, and I know his number.
Right, it's like a scheduled call.
It's a scheduled
like, okay.
call. It's like, we're allowing this to happen, but then she immediately is like, the second that there's any emotional connection whatsoever, like somehow she's on the line, but she's like, no.
Shut up. Yeah.
I want to see Ariadne?
Yeah.
I want to see her pick out her totem, like a montage, yeah. Like going to like a toy store,
or
like,
a yard
getting like
sale.
Pogs or like Jacks. I'm like, I can't use Jacks. That's not going to work. Just going through all the little
want,
trinkets.
Like really stupid totems. Like, what'd you get? Snap bracelet.
Right. Yeah. Or like one of those sticky hands you throw on the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a Super Bowl.
They're also like iconic and like cryptic, and like it's a top and it's like a cool looking
right.
one. Like
she's just got
like Jack.
Ariadne, take out your squand. Check it out.
Yeah, you gotta know it's real. I had one more scene. I just want to see when they all wake up. I want to see Yusuf, the chemist, just get up and pee for like 4 or 5 seconds.
Right.
Because all we know about his character for the last hour is that he's really had to pee. Because that's why it's raining.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, dude, I gotta pee. I'm like crashing this van.
He could have pissed himself.
He might have.
Van.
He might have.
I mean, it's in a dream, right?
Yeah, he probably just pissed himself on the plane.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Because he's asleep.
Peed all over himself.
Just doesn't care.
And well, he can't wake up. Like, peeing isn't going to wake him up, right? You have to have that kick motion.
Right, yeah.
So, like, anything goes.
Anything goes, as Levitt shows
us. That could be his kick.
Just explode
just
an
drop
elevator.
Drop his hand into a warm bowl of water, and he just pees.
This is a random thought.
I'm awake now.
Asked Nolan in an interview about that DuckTales comic. Do you know about that?
No.
No.
There's an old DuckTales comic that is Inception. Basically.
Are you sure it's not Donald Duck? I think we've done it on the site, but
we have done it on the site. I'm not. It might
if
be
it,
Donald
it might be
Duck.
DuckTales. I don't know.
I think
a duck is involved.
A duck is involved, and the duck talks, and he's got a duck family that also talks.
And it's like.
And it's like you wear these headphones and you hook yourself up to a machine and you go inside dreams to like. Give people ideas and stuff, and you have to get knocked over in a chair to wake up.
Yeah.
It's all there. And I want to be like, did you read this comic and like it?
Did you steal this from Donald?
Did DuckTales incept you?
Were you incepted by Donald? All right, so we watched the movie. Now we're going to make some observations that you might not have heard, not really directly related to what we think is actually happening in the movie, but what might be happening in the movie. It's something we like to call Let's Overthink It. So Limbo's actually the easiest place to escape from.
Yeah, not the hardest.
Not the hardest. Like, they're making a big fucking deal about getting sent to Limbo. It's like, no, if you die here, you get sent to Limbo. It could be for 50 years or eternity. We don't know. First of all, it won't be for eternity because your living body that's not whatever will starve to death eventually. Like,
yeah.
Like, you'll die in a week.
Right,
so,
which would be, years in limbo, but not...
Probably a long time.
Yeah,
they say?
But like, not forever.
Not forever. You would not be there for an eternity. And all you have to do is die in limbo. So if you know you're in limbo, because they established that, like, that's, you know, the whole reason Leo tricks Maul into thinking their reality is not real so that she will go with him to lay down on a train track and kill themselves awake. As soon as they get run over by the train, they wake all the way back up. They don't go to different levels. They go all the way back to...
It unfolds completely.
But, so, like, why... Every kick they employ while they're in the dreams, they're all lethal.
Right.
They're all fatal kicks.
You can die in any one of them.
So, the only one that makes sense, then, is when Fisher and Ariadne fall off the building in Limbo and they land. That should have woken them all the way up. They should wake up on the plane.
But instead they go
They
to
go
the,
back to level 3.
Yeah. Fortress.
And then the fortress collapses, which kills them.
Sending them.
So it should send them to Limbo.
Right.
Not back up to the van.
Right.
Or not, I'm sorry, not back up to the hotel.
Yeah.
And then JGL blows up an elevator and launches them into the top of the elevator.
Which gets them back in
also
the van.
Dead.
Yeah. Mm.
That should send them back to Limbo, not
so
to the van.
So how does the death kick interaction work?
How is it a kick and not just dying?
Yeah, because, yeah.
And then the van itself would probably be fatal.
It might be the most damning statement about the movie is that...
They kill a bunch of people.
Well, it's that the suspension of the disbelief of, like, the logic of everything that they say says one thing, that you will die if you die in this dream or you'll wake up. And then the kick thing is completely aside from that and isn't even in the conversation yet when it actually is taken out. It's like the rules that you said before...
Right, because you have to make an extreme kick do it, but the extreme kick would kill you.
Murder kick.
I don't need to be murdered awake, thank you. Which I read an interview with Nolan where he's like, and this is a statement that I very much agree with, I think probably anyone would, where he says, it's important to play by the rules of your film. It's like you can absolutely set the rules. Like you can give, it's sort of like saying, oh, well, we can fly through space because warp drive works. So you can establish the rules in a movie that are beyond reality, but you have to follow them.
Yeah.
Like, as long as you follow your own rules, then people will go with you because they're like, okay, this, you've told me why this makes sense, and I accept that. So as long as you follow your own rules that you've set, people will have no problem accepting what's going on. But he definitely doesn't do it in this movie.
Yeah. Needs some Neil deGrasse Tyson tweets to point out some mistakes.
Yeah. So the stars are wrong.
Actually, dreams. All right.
The other point that I wanted to make about this movie is related to that. The movie itself operates on dream logic, which a lot of Nolan films do, in the sense that while you're watching the movie, you're with it.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, sure, yeah. Like, you're going, like, yeah, okay, the van's going to, you know, yeah, the kick will, the elevator will bring him back up to the, like, he's good enough that he gets you and brings you along, and you accept it the whole way. You're like, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. It's only afterward, when you're thinking about the movie later, that you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. Like, why does that work? Like, why do they all have dream briefcases in every level? Why do they need them in this? Like, it's just like how do you fall asleep in a dream? Like, that doesn't happen. Like, why did they have an extra dream briefcase in level 3 to go to limbo? They weren't planning on going to limbo. They specifically weren't going to go to limbo. And if you can just dream up anything you want at any time, like, why wouldn't they just sit there and be like, in the first level when they get cornered by Fisher's security team, why don't they be like, well, we've got a tank now. Like,
also, they have this like serum that is like amazing because it puts you out instantly, but you are super lucid.
Right. Your ear stuff is fine.
Yeah. And then does that carry through the dreams? Because like that really was only physically applied in the first reality.
If you get kicked awake, then that like wears off the serum?
I think like, the serum was only applied once.
Because you're still drugged as fuck.
Yeah, right, like, you're not going to like get kicked awake and be like, oh, the drugs wore off.
You're going to be like doped up as shit.
But that's all logic because it's like, yeah, well, I have this special thing. I'm an alchemist and I made this
special
thing.
Yeah, he kind of goes
but
they do refer to him as an alchemist.
Every iteration under that, it's like they just like pull out the machine, push it in, and they go like, and they just like fall back on the bed and instantly and they're in the next...
I feel like they never establish, the things that he doesn't establish, he just skips right over. That's another Nolan thing.
Right, yeah.
I mean, a lot of filmmakers do that, but like...
The Prestige, we talked about this
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. And I do feel like all of his dreams, all of his movies operate on dream logic.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you're in it and you're like, yeah! And then as you think about it like 2 hours later, you're like, wait, why, that doesn't make any sense. Like, how does Tom Hardy forge to look like Tom Berenger?
Right.
Does he just think Tom Berenger thoughts as he falls asleep and then he wakes up as Tom Berenger?
No, he's just like one of the faceless men.
that whole conversation with them at the cafe is kind of just him talking about his movies.
Yeah.
He talks about, like you wake up in the dream and then you're like, wait, that didn't really make any sense. He also talks about like an idea catching on and then it like changes you, it's with you. And like even he has this idea for like Inception from reading DuckTales. and then like it consumes him and he tries to make it and for like, what, you said 8 or 10 years or something.
Right. Many, many years.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Another thought about this. This is a world in which dream heists are a thing.
Right. Does everyone on the planet know that you can do this?
It seems like it.
It does seem like it.
And I feel like that's probably why Leo's going to go to jail.
Yeah.
He's not going to jail for throwing his wife out of the window because she was across the street.
Right.
Any gumshoe worth their salt would be able to tell you she fell from that window, not from that one where Dom was.
Yeah.
It's definitely a phrase, any gumshoe worth their salt.
Yeah. But... So I feel like he's kind of lying a little bit when he's telling, oh yeah, she sent a letter to, she had herself declared sane by 3 psychiatrists, which is an insane sentence.
That's weird, yeah.
and then she sent a letter to our lawyer. She's like, I sent a letter to my lawyer saying I was afraid for my safety. I feel like that's a lie. I feel like he's gonna go to prison because they know that he incepted her.
Yeah,
it's like you doing this, you played with her mind and caused her to die. Right. That's manslaughter at least.
Yeah, like, you created craziness.
Yeah, you fomented the idea right. on a intense, like, unprecedented level that we don't have legislation for right now. But, like, I have to believe that's some prison time.
I mean, there's a good utility of it. Yeah. Like, to incept the president to be a better person, for example.
Hmm.
Might be a good thought. But, you know, can't. Legal that.
Can't legal that.
Yeah, there's no way to legal that.
You can't sane crazy.
You can't sane crazy.
So we talked about this movie. Now we're going to talk about whether or not this movie deserves to go on the gold record of all movies that we eventually shoot into space like a celestial discus, hoping some alien race will intercept it. The question we'd like to ask is, do we show this movie to aliens?
So, I don't know. Like, it depends on the aliens, I guess. Because if you show this to them, they could easily see this and go, well, that doesn't make any sense. This is dumb. This is a bad movie. You don't understand. You don't get it, you humans. But they might see it and think, like, oh, this is it's like an interesting kind of fun movie. Like, do they take things literally? Do they think, how do they view our movies, you know?
You have to consider all possibilities.
Yeah.
You don't know.
They may not know it's a film.
So
if we only get one Nolan movie, I would say no.
Okay.
Interstellar, probably, I think we should.
That's the one to show them aliens.
Yeah.
Look, space, a common ground.
We are you.
We are you. So don't murder us.
I think I'm going to, wow, shoot. This is a legit tough one. Because in terms of, well, how would the aliens respond to it? Like there's a, maybe they think it's a nice movie if they have art. And they know what and understand what art is. Like maybe they enjoy that. Maybe they know what Inception is and they have Inception and Dream Thievery, but like ours, this movie's like a quaint, stupid version of it. So maybe they watch it ironically and are like, yeah, look at that. You know,
right. This is what they think Inception is like.
Yeah. They watch it like you fucking watch that Stallone movie Cobra. Where you're just like, yeah, look at this. So maybe it might be really delightful film for them, but gosh. And then, maybe.
I'm going to come down hard on the yes category.
You're saying yes.
Definitely do. Reason is that I want them to believe that we are capable of this.
Of dream so that they, what if they don't dream, Abe?
Doesn't matter. They're just be like, these people can influence our thoughts, and that's like the best thing we have. So, as I usually do in this podcast, come down hard on the aliens should fear us.
If this makes them fear us and they decide to destroy the planet because
I want them to fear us like everyone fears the A-bomb. Is the bomb big enough to end all war? I want this one ends all war. If it's like,
right, let's
I
not
could
poke
just
that
enter your brain, buddy. Do you want to go to war with me? I can go into your brain.
I can steal your dreams.
Yeah. Not that we're going to do it. It's not a promise. It's just like, hey, we're capable of this.
Not a promise. This film is not a letter of intent.
Yeah, it's just dream deterrent.
All right.
Yeah, we're done here, but we want to talk about how you can talk to us. So check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at @CrackedMoviePod. Please hit us up with some thoughts, people. We've been Abe, Tom, and Cody. Cody, where can we find you online?
I'm online, on the website. Also on the Twitter.com. My handle is Dr. Mr. Cody, DrMisterCody. And that's all I'm willing to tell you.
All right.
That's all you get.
Yeah. I'm Dr. Mr. Cody on all the things.
Acceptable guest
all of the things.
Social media plug. we've been honored that you've joined us here.
Yeah, thanks,
this was
Ben.
A very
I'm
good one.
Honored to have been invited.
Well, next week we'll be talking about another Nolan film, Memento.
Yeah. Right? It's first big one.
Yeah.
Well, the one that everybody
got him on the map.
Got him on the map, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And also everyone in the comment threads, we're open to films and directors you think we should talk about. So let us know. We're not joking.
Yeah, no, we do read
them.
We are reading them.
That's it.
Yeah.
Watch
Thank you guys so much.
Love you.
Whovians and Misties, you guys are in for a treat. On August 17th, join the stars of Mystery Science Theater 3000, Mike Nelson, Kevin Murphy, and Bill Corbett live in movie theaters nationwide as they take on the 1983 Doctor Who film, The Five Doctors. For locations and to purchase tickets, visit www.fathomevents.com/rifftracksdoctorwho.
James Bonding Podcast.
James Bonding is back. I'm Matt Gourley.
And I'm Matt Myra. We are officially back with weekly episodes of the James Bonding Podcast exclusively on Earwolf.
We'll be tackling all of the movies, official and unofficial, and a whole lot in between.
That's right. You might want us to talk about James Bond Jr. Stop asking. We might.
We won't. But we'll talk about a lot of other things. Why should you trust us?
Because we're James Bond lovers.
Not experts.
Subscribe now.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.